The headline: Syria calls on Turkey to stop its hostile behavior and end the deadly airstrikes on its territory. Tehran criticizes London for supporting a Saudi-funded television channel that propagates terror and violence in Iran. And also in our headlines, Ukraine is pushing for UN Security Council action against Russian airstrikes targeting its infrastructure. Hello and welcome, everybody. Here in the Iranian capital, Tehran, this is World News. This is our top story for this half hour. Syria is strongly critical of Turkey over the recent wave of airstrikes targeting its territory, calling for the deadly operations to be immediately halted.
The current military hostilities are a continuation of Turkey's long-standing hostile behaviors. First, it undermines previous agreements reached between Syria and Turkey, and moreover, it leads to civilian casualties. Neither Syria nor countries in this or any other country will agree with it.
The diplomat said that Syria deems the security of its borders with Turkey as extremely important. He, however, said that such security should be obtained through dialogue and cooperation rather than attacks or incursion. He also called Turkey's airstrikes a breach of both international law and Syria's sovereignty. The deputy minister made the remarks during the 19th summit of the Astana peace process, which aims to find a political solution to the crisis in Syria. Turkey started hitting areas in northeastern Syria 2 years ago, but it has intensified the strikes since last week, when an explosion in Istanbul killed six people. Ankara blames the bombing on Kurdish militant groups based in Iraq and Syria. According to the Turkish defense minister, attacks on 500 targets have already killed over 250 militants. Well, Tehran has strongly slammed the UK's support for a London-based Saudi-funded anti-Iran TV channel. Foreign Ministry spokesman Nasser Kanani said the British Foreign Secretary's claim to taking, quote, the importance of free, honest, and open journalism incredibly seriously was just an empty allegation. He added that the channel supported by James Cleverly is freely propagating terror and violence against the Iranian nation and its national security. Kanani reminded Cleverly that his backing for the Saudi-funded Iran International Channel amounts to supporting the anti-Iran war room. Iran's intelligence ministry has designated Iran International Channel as a terrorist organization over its role in stoking the recent riots in the country. Tehran University professor Sayed Mohammad Marandi says the West-based Persian language media would have been immediately shut down if they were addressing the English-speaking audience as they support spread of violence.
There's no doubt that the Americans and the Europeans are deeply involved in these very violent riots. And we know they're violent because well over 40 police officers and Basij members were murdered by these different rioters. And the United States and the Europeans, if this had happened in their own countries, they wouldn't tolerate any of this. But these rioters are being egged on by Persian language media based in the West, largely in London, funded by the West and the Saudis. And these media outlets are calling the killings and the burnings and the beatings as legitimate. So Ofcom, if this was these were English language media directed towards English-speaking countries, they would shut these television stations down immediately and arrest these people. But when it comes to Iran, it's all fair game.
Tehran says reaching an agreement regarding the revival of the 2015 Iran deal is high on the agenda. Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian stresses that the Islamic Republic is insisting on its red line, saying that a deal is quite feasible if Tehran's demands are met. Gisumi Shahadi has more.
Deal or no deal? While the EU is still reluctant to lay its negotiating cards on the table, at a press conference in the capital, Tehran, Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian stressed that Iran's negotiating team is ready for the next round of talks and is waiting for the bloc's foreign policy chief, Joseph Borrell, to set a date for ministerial-level negotiations.
We have made our stance clear, and in the previous negotiations, we communicated our views regarding the remaining issues. Last week, we announced that we are ready for the next round of talks, and now Mr. Borrell is following up and trying to set a date. Obviously, talk will continue if we make sure that our logical demands are met.
In the words of Hossein Amir Abdullahian, resolving the remaining issues with the IAEA, receiving guarantees on the economic benefits of the deal for Iran, and removing unilateral sanctions are the three key issues that need to be worked out.
The JCPOA revival talks are high on the agenda, and we are adamantly following up on the issue. Of course, this will happen when we make sure that our reasonable demands in line with our national interests are met.
According to the top diplomat, Iran and the U.S. continue to exchange messages. However, American officials take what Amir Abdullahian calls a hypocritical stance while talking to mainstream media by making comments that contradict the messages that they send to Iran.
The International Atomic Energy Agency has always deviated from its technical path and taken a political stance. European and American negotiators had promised that this would not happen again, but they broke their promise yet another time.
These comments come after a recent anti-Iran resolution passed by the IAEA Board of Governors prompted the Islamic Republic to announce that it will begin 60% uranium enrichment in its Fordo nuclear facility.
Over the past couple of years, Iran has demonstrated in practice that it is committed to the JCPOA, or the nuclear deal. It has always been the other side that has neglected the agreement. Now, Iran says for these negotiations to reach a final conclusion, it is necessary for the other side to offer some guarantees that it will remain committed to any agreement that is reached. Gisumisha Ahmadi, Tehran.
Ukraine is pressing the UN Security Council to take action against Russia's airstrikes, which it says have devastated its infrastructure in recent weeks.
We are awaiting a very firm reaction of the world to today's Russian terror, response of our partners, response of our friends, not just observers, but a reaction from all those who really recognize the UN Charter. We're doing everything possible. Ukraine represented a peace formula. The world heard it, 10 items in order to empower the Charter of UN and violated by Russian guarantee security for Ukraine, Europe, and all the peoples of this planet suffering from the consequences of the Russian aggression.
Addressing an urgent meeting of the UN Security Council, Zelensky claimed that in the past 24 hours alone, Russia has fired more than 70 missiles at Ukraine. He said that the airstrikes have affected houses, schools, hospitals, and transportation systems. Moldova's permanent representative to the UN also condemned Russia's attacks on Ukraine, saying the strikes have taken a toll on his country as well. He said more than half of Moldova was left without electricity last week, with some areas still experiencing power outages. Also speaking at the same session was Russia's envoy, who offered Moscow's narrative of the events.
The damage to residential housing and victims among the peaceful population is indeed caused by the Ukrainian air defense systems, which are not located at the outskirts of the cities, but in the very center. As a result, the missiles, those that hit those places which Russia never targeted. So, for example, today, users posted photos on the internet of missiles that hit residential homes in Kiev. Turns out that these were American air defense missiles, which were supplied to Kiev.
The Russian envoy also criticized Kiev and its Western supporters for their threats and ultimatums. Moscow denies carrying out attacks on non-military targets. It has also condemned the West for covering up the crimes of the Ukrainian military in pro-Russia areas. Johnny Miller is joining us now from Donetsk. Johnny, first of all, talk to us about Ukraine's recent requests from the UN Security Council. Also, if you may, give us an update from the situation on the ground as well.
Yes, yesterday we saw some of the largest missile strikes by Russia against Ukrainian civil infrastructure, energy infrastructure so far. And frankly, it's bringing Ukraine's energy infrastructure to breaking point. I spoke to a contact in Kiev yesterday. She told me that previous to these strikes, there was only 2 hours of electricity a day for people in Kiev. That was scheduled 2 hours, then it became random 2 hours, so people didn't know when electricity was going to go on. She told me that because of these strikes today, there is no electricity whatsoever, there is no water. Thankfully, heating is still on. Ukrainian winter is very harsh, of course, and if the heating was to go off in Kiev and other cities, it would be difficult to see how civilians would carry on. These strikes against energy infrastructure is causing huge damage to the ability of Ukraine to be able to look after the basic needs of its people. That's why Zelensky is going to the United Nations and calling for assistance. But it's also important to recognize that while Russia has been striking this energy infrastructure for a month or so now, Ukraine has been hitting civil infrastructure here in Donbass, where I am, intermittently for the last 8 years, and particularly since February this year when Russia invaded. Just last night at about 11:30, the whistle of missiles flew over my apartment and hit a passport office in the center of Donetsk. Ukraine has been it's been hitting hospitals, schools, water, electricity in Donbass for many years, particularly over recent months. So frankly, both sides are trying to hit and are succeeding in hitting civil infrastructure. And the only way that both sides are going to stop hitting energy infrastructure is for there to be peace negotiations. But there doesn't seem to be any appetite for that at the moment.
All right, thanks a lot, Johnny Miller, joining us from Donetsk. Elsewhere, UK energy companies will increase gas and electricity prices from January, forcing the government to raise its price cap. Britain's energy regulator, Ofgem, said companies can charge more for energy from next year, but households will be protected from the price hike. Under the Energy Price Guarantee, EPG, the typical household is currently paying £2,500 a year for energy. But Ofgem says that without government support, households would have paid £4,200 from January. The price cap was introduced in October. This comes amid concerns about the cost of the EPG at a time when the government's debt is rising. Analysts at Cornwall Insight have said that capping gas and electricity prices for the next 2 years could cost up to £140 billion. Europe is facing its worst energy crisis in decades due to the fallout from the Ukraine war and the COVID-19 pandemic. EU Home Affairs ministers are set to hold an emergency meeting on Friday to discuss the growing refugee crisis in the 27-nation bloc. This is lawmakers in the European Parliament are critical of the EU's treatment of refugees. Jerome Hughes reports from Brussels.
The recent decision by Italy to close its ports to the Ocean Viking vessel carrying 234 refugees has been slated in the European Parliament. The vessel, operated by a charity, was eventually allowed to dock in France.
How cynical is it that NGOs filling this gap and saving lives are criminalised, whereas the states violating their obligation enjoy impunity?
Asylum applications have increased by 60% in the EU during the past 12 months. That figure is separate from those arriving from Ukraine. In fact, the 27 EU nations are providing maximum support to Ukrainians, while those from other countries are often forced to sleep on the streets.
How dare so many of you define yourself as Christians and repeat that you are defending Christian values when your ideas and your actions are proof of the opposite.
In the Mediterranean alone, 2,000 refugees have drowned so far this year, according to the International Organization for Migration. The message seems to be, if you're not one of the 4 million Ukrainians who have arrived in the EU in recent months, you're not welcome. It's suggested war hawks in the US and NATO don't give a damn about the millions of people who have been displaced through military intervention in countries such as Iraq, Afghanistan, Syria, Yemen and Libya. Apparently, the far right is flourishing in the EU due to the bloc's neglect of refugees.
How did Lega get big? How did the AfD get big? How did Marine Le Pen get big? It's all by capitalizing on the fears of migration.
The ascent of the extreme right in the EU is certainly bad news for asylum seekers, according to analysts.
What this is doing is this is leading to a rise in xenophobia. These refugees, these people who, as I said, are at the lowest possible ebb, are now being subject to abuse and to hate crimes.
EU Home Affairs ministers will hold an emergency meeting on the refugee crisis this Friday. There's a great deal of scepticism that anything will be achieved. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Also, North Korea is reacting angrily to a push by its southern neighbor for additional sanctions on Pyongyang over its missile launches in recent weeks. North Korean leader's sister, Kim Yo-jong, has described the South Korean president and his administration, using her own words, as idiots who are parroting the United States. She's even compared the government in Seoul to a faithful dog, which is owned by Washington. Kim also warned that additional sanctions and pressure would only add to the North's hostility and anger. Meanwhile, the South has called these comments deplorable. Seoul this week announced it was considering fresh unilateral sanctions on the North over its recent missile tests, including an intercontinental ballistic one last week. But the North keeps insisting that the weapons tests are a response to provocations by Seoul and Washington, particularly their massive military drills, which destabilize the peninsula. A fresh strike by South Korean truckers is threatening to disrupt manufacturing and fuel supplies for industries. Unionized truckers are walking out over a minimum pay system, which the government has already agreed to extend for 3 more years. But the truckers now want the government to make this scheme permanent. Organizers have warned the strike could stop oil supplies at major refineries and transport at major ports and industrial plants. In response, the government is considering deploying military trucks for urgent transport and securing more storage space in case cargoes pile up. Also, gas station owners have been asked to secure enough inventories ahead of the strike. This is the second major strike by truckers in less than 6 months. China is reporting the highest number of daily COVID cases since the start of the pandemic nearly 3 years ago. According to the Health Bureau, there were more than 31,000 new local infections on Wednesday, minus the imported cases. The number broke the previous record set in April. The government has been working to curb the spread with snap lockdowns, mass testing, and travel restrictions. Under Beijing's zero COVID policy, even small outbreaks can shut down entire cities. But the radical rules have caused public frustration. On Wednesday, hundreds of workers protested at a flagship iPhone plant in Zhengzhou over salaries and conditions. And now the city has ordered a lockdown after the protest, as the number of COVID cases hit a daily record. Residents there can only leave the area with a negative COVID test and permission from local authorities. And that brings us to an end here on this edition of World News. Do stay tuned, though. Bye.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood qudde saratani Israel mukhalifim.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
Wajh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Current world order will be replaced by a new order where US is isolated, Asia powerful, resistance front expanded. This is the part of a speech delivered by the leader of the Islamic Revolution during a meeting with students on Wednesday, November 2nd, 2022. This meeting was held on the occasion of National Students' Day and National Day of Fighting Against Global Arrogance, which are commemorated on the 13th of Aban, 4th of November. Well, the America of today is the same America of yesterday. The America of today is the same America of August 19, 1953. It is the same America that held Saddam Hussein. It is the same America of the past few years, with one or two important differences which we must pay attention to. First of all, the enemy's tactics have become more complex. We need to pay attention to this. The enmities remain the same, but the methods of applying these enmities are different and more complex. It is not easy to untie the knots. You need to pay attention. You need to be alert. Of course, we trust our own children, our own youth, and our own officials.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
We know they are capable of dealing with things that are complicated, but it is complex. That is one difference. Secondly, that day, the 9th of August, and the like, and even until the beginning of the revolution, the US was the dominant power in the world. But that is not how it is today. This is one important difference. Today, the US is not the world's dominant power. Many of the world's political analysts believe that the US is declining. It is gradually melting away. We aren't the ones saying this. Of course, we have the same opinion, but the world's political analysts are also saying it. The signs are evident. The United States' domestic problems are unprecedented in the economic, social, and moral fields, as well as their internal conflicts and the blood-stained divisions inside the country. Another sign is also their miscalculation of the world's affairs. For example, 20 years ago, they attacked Afghanistan. The Taliban were in power at that time.
Allah, I wanna thank you. I wanna thank you for all the things that you've done.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
International Atomic Energy Agency has once again shown that it is acting on a political capacity rather than a technical one. The IAEA Board of Governors adopted an anti-Iran resolution despite Tehran's positive and constructive cooperation with the agency. Iran's foreign ministry says the politically motivated resolution was issued while Iran has the most transparent peaceful nuclear program in terms of the number of facilities under the supervision of the International Atomic Energy Agency compared to other countries and the number of inspections its nuclear activities have undergone by the IAEA. Foreign Ministry spokesman Nasser Kanani stressed that the resolution was enforced after the US and the three European countries, Britain, France, and Germany, exerted pressure on the agency's board of governors. Earlier, Kanani had said Iran took the first step in responding to the resolution. That came as director of the Atomic Energy Organization of Iran, Mohammad Islami, said earlier in the day that the Islamic Republic will give a firm response to the anti-Iran resolution. Iranian officials have stated that Tehran won't bow to pressure and that Iran will continue its peaceful nuclear program in accordance with its needs and in compliance with its international obligations. Also, Iran's foreign ministry has earlier slammed the instrumental use of the international organizations against independent nations, saying that has become a norm of the foreign policy of Western countries. The resolution adopted on Thursday is the second resolution passed by IAEA this year, and calls on Tehran to fully cooperate with the agency's probe into uranium traces at three alleged undeclared sites in Iran. Tehran says the IAEA is basing its statements on information fabricated by Israel. Iran has started enriching uranium to the purity level of 60% at its Fordo nuclear facility following the recent resolution that the U.S. and the European Troika initiated at the UN Nuclear Agency's Board of Governors to mount pressure on the Islamic Republic. Tehran has informed the International Atomic Energy Agency of its decision via a letter. It described the move as a strong message to the recent anti-Iran resolution passed by the IAEA's Board of Governors. Iran also installed two new IR-2M and IR-4 cascades at the Natanz and Fordo facilities, which have now reached the stage prior to the injection of uranium gas into centrifuges. This means that Iran has practically imitated uranium enrichment by means of the new cascades, and the process will finish within the next few days. Moreover, Iran has fitted and launched new centrifuges at two empty holes in Fordo and Natanz nuclear sites, in what is deemed as a decisive response to the resolution against the country. The holes under Iran's commitment to the terms of the landmark 2015 nuclear deal, officially known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, had been vacant, but centrifuges have been installed there once again. The report went on to point to the replacement of IR-1 centrifuges at Fordo with IR-6 as Iran's fourth important move against the IAEA resolution, stressing that the measures will increase enrichment at the site by 10 times. The latest measures are set to be in line with a law approved by the Iranian parliament to counter unilateral sanctions imposed by the United States on Tehran. The Iranian parliament passed the law, dubbed the Strategic Action Plan to Counter Sanctions, in December 2020, prompting the Iranian administration to restrict the IAEA's inspections and accelerate the development of the country's nuclear program beyond the limits set by the JCPOA. Iran took five steps in scaling back its obligations, among them abandoning operational limitations on its nuclear industry, including with regard to the capacity and level of uranium enrichment. All those measures were adopted after informing the IAEA beforehand, with the agency's inspectors present on the ground in Iran. Negotiators from nearly 200 countries at the COP27 UN Climate Summit in Egypt agreed to set up a loss and damage fund meant to help vulnerable countries cope with climate disasters. They also agreed the globe needs to cut greenhouse gas emissions nearly in half by 2030. The agreement also reaffirmed the goal of keeping global warming to 1.5 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels. However, for the 27th time, the UN climate talks have failed to directly address the biggest driver of the climate crisis, the production of gas, oil, and coal. This is amid calls for the phase-out of all fossil fuels inside the conference walls and beyond. More than 80 countries had supported a proposal to phase down the use of fossil fuels at the UN climate summit. Ultimately, an attempt to address the biggest source of the planet warming emissions that are causing the climate crisis ended in a fiasco, as the participants only agreed to phase down polluting coal power and phase out inefficient fossil fuel subsidies. That's after a number of oil and gas producing nations, led by Saudi Arabia, blocked a key proposal to phase out all fossil fuels, not just coal. German Foreign Minister Annalena Baerbock said it is more than frustrating to see overdue steps on mitigation and the phase-out of fossil energies being stonewalled by a number of large emitters and oil producers. Addressing the summit, the European Union's climate chief, Frans Timmermans, said the EU was disappointed with the final outcome of the summit.
What we have in front of us is not enough of a step forward for people and planet. We should have done much more.
The UN chief, Antonio Guterres, reacted with saying that the COP27 climate talks had fallen short in pushing for the urgent, drastic carbon cutting needed to tackle global warming.
Our planet is still in the emergency room. We need to drastically reduce emissions now, and this is an issue this COP did not address.
Environmental campaigners labeled the COP27 summit as yet another monumental failure to tackle climate crisis. Activists blasted richer countries for not doing more to limit carbon emissions. They say the US, EU, UK, and others came to the summit with empty words, hollow promises, and the refusal to take responsibility for having set the planet on fire and destroying millions of lives and livelihoods. While the agreement to establish a loss and damage fund represents immense progress for vulnerable nations who have been calling for finance to address the impacts of climate change for many years, this win is bittersweet. The failure to address the root cause of loss and damage through agreeing to phase out oil, gas, and coal will mean more loss and damage in future. Currently, approximately 84% of the world's energy needs are met from the usage of fossil fuels, especially oil. In 2021, the world consumed nearly 490 exajoules of fossil fuels. That amounts to an unfathomable figure of epic proportions. The world is on track to produce more than double the fossil fuels that are compatible with a 1.5 degrees Celsius target. The fossil fuel industry is also earning 11-figure profits from this addiction, while households struggle to afford basic needs and over 1 billion people live with almost no modern energy. Africa alone is home to 600 million people without access to electricity. The US and China top in fossil fuel consumption. According to data, an average American consumes at least 23 barrels of petroleum every year. With billions of dollars invested every year into establishing wars, strengthening military and weaponry technologies by developed nations, they still have not come up with a concrete solution to end complete dependency on fossil fuels. Future changes are expected to include a warmer atmosphere, a warmer and more acidic ocean, higher sea levels, and larger changes in precipitation patterns. The extent of future climate change depends on what we do now to reduce greenhouse gases.
Security services, the fake Israeli regime, and certain Western politicians that have engineered plots to spark a civil war, destroy and break up Iran, must know that Iran is neither Libya nor Sudan. That was what Iran's foreign minister tweeted recently. Abdullahian said that Iran's enemies have their eyes set on Iran's territorial integrity and identity, accusing Israel and Western intelligence services of plotting to start a civil war in the Islamic Republic. The statements were confirmed by a leaked audio from a presenter at UK's state-funded news channel, BBC Persian. Abdullahian had good reason to relay those sentiments. The statements came on the heels of a number of terrorist attacks in the Islamic Republic. One took place in Izeh, in the southwestern province of Khuzestan, killing 7 people, including a 9-year-old boy and woman. The other took place in Isfahan, in which terrorists attacked security forces and killed 3 of them. There's a vicious anti-Iran media campaign led by terrorist media outlets like the Saudi-funded Iran International, which are twisting the truth and are accusing Iranian security forces of committing the terrorist acts. This stage of the anti-Iran plot is called an armed one, something that the former U.S. National Security Advisor John Bolton warned about. He claimed that subversive elements in Iran, which he dubbed as the opposition, were arming themselves with weapons stolen from besieged forces and smuggled from Iraq's Kurdistan. This was evident when an uptick in the number of security forces killed were reported during 3 days, from November 15th through November 18th. During this period, 14 security forces were reported to have been victims of terrorist attacks. The terrorist killings in Izeh, Isfahan, and Mashhad, which followed a recent similar attack against pilgrims and worshippers at the shrine of Shah Cheragh in Shiraz, also showed that the enemy plots have failed, and they are now subscribing to terrorist acts involving firearms and weapons. Iran has blasted the silence of the international community over the recent terrorist attacks. It blamed foreign powers for promoting and encouraging violence and terrorism. Further said that their silence is testament to that, saying undoubtedly the international silence of claimants of human rights and foreign promoters of chaos and violence in Iran in the face of the most blatant terrorist operations in a number of Iranian cities conveys no other message than encouragement of terrorism and the promotion of terrorism across the world. The Iranian city of Mashhad. Funeral processions were held for 3 besieged volunteer force members who were stabbed to death by rioters earlier this week. The turnout in the tens of thousands. Iran's leader has stated that they are trying to give the impression that large numbers of people are opposed to the Islamic establishment in order to impress ignorant individuals. However, the leader noted that the people's mass presence on stage to safeguard the Islamic revolution amounts to a slap in the face of ill-wishers. That became even more evident when the following day in Isfahan, again, people showed up in large numbers, tens of thousands, to pay their last respects to the victims while condemning all acts of violence and terror. Putting these scenes next to each other, there is no comparison. The Saudi-funded Iran International depiction of what is happening in Iran is far from reality, to the point that the channel, which Iran has named a terrorist entity, is actively promoting and encouraging not only acts of violence, but is under the delusional impression that there is a revolution underway in Iran. The scenes, when put next to each other, speak for themselves.
For weeks, Iran has witnessed unrest and riots in its different cities. The unrest started after a young woman named Mahsa Amini fainted in police custody and later died in hospital. The protests were initially peaceful, but violent elements supported by Western spy agencies hijacked the protests and turned into violent riots. The unrest has provided the fertile ground for Western governments and spy agencies to launch a media warfare on Iran and create anti-Iran fake news. A recent notorious case in point is the recent tweet by Canada's Prime Minister Justin Trudeau. In the controversial tweet, the Canadian Premier had claimed that Iran has sentenced 15,000 protesters to death. The false claim, which has been part of the media campaign against Iran, has been circulating on social media in recent days. The inaccurate tweet was live on Trudeau's official Twitter account for almost 12 hours before it was deleted. Several Western celebrities and news outlets, including the Newsweek, also shared the erroneous information. This is not the only case of false news propagated against Iran. When the protests first started in Iran, Western-backed propaganda outlets claimed that Mahsa Amini was beaten to death by Iranian police forces. Following an elaborate investigation, that claim also proved to be false. It's now become a common practice for these propaganda machines to publish unverified footages on protests in Iran. Back in September 2022, US media outlets ran a controversial report. The report was widely discussed and celebrated in anti-Iran outlets. But it turned out to be a fake report after Ayatollah Khamenei publicly attended a military ceremony in Tehran in October. The false report was propagated by Western outlets as Iran was battling the Western-backed riots. Social media platforms have also turned into a battleground of narratives against Iran. Analysis shows those tweeting the hashtags associated with the unrest showed a striking number of new accounts created since the protests started.
In August 2011, when there were riots in London because someone was shot and killed by the police, a number of people were killed. I don't recall the exact number. But big tech, Facebook, back then BlackBerry, and Twitter cooperated with the British government. In the case of Iran, big tech is used as a weapon against Iranians. So Iranian voices don't come out. Iranians lose their, if they are opposed to the Western narrative, they get sanctioned. All of the Iranian media is sanctioned. Many individuals have lost their accounts. I have lost my Facebook and Instagram accounts. So these Western big tech companies, they cooperate with Western governments, even though in the riots in London, people were killed, and they arrested people and put them in jail for inciting riots. But in Iran, these same media outlets make threats, they support, they help people make Molotov cocktails, and they help mobilize the rioters.
The online anti-Iran campaign is fed by fake accounts used by members of the anti-Iran Mujahideen-e-Khalq organization terrorist cult who are stationed in Albania and so-called journalists employed by the Saudi-funded London-based Iran International TV, which is now on Tehran's terror blacklist. The television channel has openly been promoting monarchists, the highly notorious MKO terror group, and most significantly, separatist terrorists. A particular case in point is a project by Western media outlets to accuse the government of killing its own citizens. They have produced a long list of citizens which they claim have been killed by security forces.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. Savior.
Oh, the Savior of mankind, please show us the sign.
To the designer of the human civilization that is established on the unity of Almighty Allah.
You are a true God.
To the redeemer of human volition and thought.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. A very warm welcome to the program The Last Savior. This is your host, Zainab. Prophet Muhammad, may peace be upon him, said, "The one who dies and does not recognize the Imam of his time will actually die the death of an ignorant." But in this program, we try to provide you with the most information regarding the Imam of your time. Yes, this is the last savior. And today we are going to discuss the signs of the advent of Imam al-Zaman, Ajallaha Ta'ala Faraja. And on that note, today in our studio, we have with us a very special guest. We have Dr. Karimi. Assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
A very warm welcome, sir.
Thank you for having me.
Well, Dr. Karimi, Yamani is considered to be a definite sign in some narrations and indefinite in some narrations. We analyzed them all. We discussed his names and we said we cannot rely on any of the names. Then we discussed about the titles. Again, we didn't reach a particular conclusion because there were so many titles, both on Shia sources and Sunni sources. But now we would want to know from you, is there any particular time about his uprising?
It's a very important question because of the fact that according to many narrations, the uprising of Yamani is very close to the reappearance of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam. When it comes to the time of the uprising of Yamani, exactly like the time of the reappearance of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam, the exact time of his uprising is not known to us.
Okay.
And it is not mentioned in the narrations at all.
All right.
So like the time of the reappearance, the time of the uprising of Yamani is also unknown to us, and no one has the right to claim and to specify any time for the uprising of Yamani too. But the point is that, according to some, or rather many narrations, Yamani, the uprising of Yamani and the uprising of Sufyani are at the same time, or they are very close to each other in terms of the time.
Yeah.
And at least it has a message for us that today, if a person claims that I'm the promised Yamani, now the question would be that, so who is the Sufyani of your time?
All right.
So the narrations are telling us that Yamani and Sufyani would be on the same time, and they will fight each other. Okay. So no one has the right to claim that I'm the promised Yamani without, any Sufyani at his time.
Okay.
So let me share some narrations in this regard. Imam Sadiq alayhi salam is quoted as saying, Al-Yamani wa Sufyani kathara sayrihan. The narration reads, Yamani and Sufyani are like two racing horses. It's a kind of similitude, saying that they will come at the same time. It seems that it was a very clear notion before the companions of the Imam of the Ahlul Bayt, especially the companions of Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, that Sufyani and Yamani would come together. Why? Because Imam Sadiq alayhi salam was asked about the uprising of Sufyani, and he says that anna yakhruju dhalik walamma yakhruj kasur aynayhi bi san'a. How is it possible for Sufyani to have a reason why Yamani has not risen yet from Sana'a?
All right.
And Imam calls Yamani as the person who will defeat Sufyani.
Okay.
So it seems that it was a very clear notion at that time that Yamani and Sufyani would come together. So when people ask Imam Sadiq alayhi salam about Sufyani, Imam gets surprised that why you are asking me about Sufyani while still there is no Yamani coming from Sana'a.
Okay.
This is in Al-Ghiba by Nu'mani, page 285, chapter 14, hadith number 60.
All right. So we'll discuss more on that after a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned with us.
I can feel your eyes like the sun shining behind the clouds. Shatter this long night forever. I need a hero to stop this thousand year old
Welcome back. You're listening to The Last Savior. We're discussing about Al-Yamani, which is considered to be one of the definite signs, and we are discussing the time of his uprising. Dr. Karimi, before going to the break, you defined for us a narration from Imam Sadiq alayhi salam. You explained that when he says that Yamani and Sufyani are like two racing horses, and then Yamani is going to defeat Sufyani. And then we again have people asking Imam like about Sufyani, and Imam is asking them, why are you asking me about Sufyani when Yamani has not came yet? Which shows that both are going to come at the same time.
Exactly. There are many other narrations in this regard telling us that Sufyani and Yamani should come together. So no one can claim that he's Yamani while there is no Sufyani.
All right.
Another narration, Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam is quoted as saying, إِذَا ظَهَرَ سُفْيَانِ عَلَى الْأَبْقَرِ وَالْمَنْصُورِ الْيَمَانِ. When Sufyani will defeat Abqa and Mansur al-Yamani, as we said, al-Mansur al-Yamani is one of the titles for Yamani.
Yes.
Then the Turks and the Romans, they will have a kind of uprising, and Sufyani will defeat them. Of course, as I mentioned later, we'll discuss about the sequence of events and whether Sufyani will defeat Yamani or Yamani will defeat Sufyani.
Okay.
But the point is that they will come together and they will fight each other. In another narration, we read, ثُمَّ يَسِيرُ إِلَيْهِمْ مَنْصُورُ الْيَمَانِ مِنْ سَنْعَى بِجُنُودِهِ. Then Mansur al-Yamani will come toward Sufyani from Sana'a together with his soldiers, and then he will have a fight with a person called Al-Akhwas. And finally, ثُمَّ يَظْهَرُ الْأَخْوَسُ أَسْتُفْيَانِ عَلَيْهِ فَيَلْتَقِي هُوَ وَالْأَخْوَسُ. Akhwas is one of the titles for Sufyani. You'll have a fight with Akhwas, which is Sufyani. And finally, according to this narration, Sufyani will defeat Al-Yamani. So the point and the conclusion from all these narrations is that Yamani and Sufyani will come together. And according to some authentic narrations, the uprising of Sufyani is one of the signs in the same year of the reappearance of Imam Mahdi.
All right.
This is mentioned in many authentic narrations. So Sufyani is one of the signs very close before the reappearance of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam.
All right.
And these narrations tell us that Yamani would be at the same time as Sufyani.
All right.
So the conclusion is that the uprising of Yamani is one of the signs which are very close to the time of the reappearance of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam. There is a narration in this regard. For example, the narration reads from Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam, the ruler, the commander of the army of Sufyani will go to a land called Baida.
Mm-hmm.
Then there would be a call from the heaven that, O Baida, swallow up this group. And mm-hmm. we have the Khasf Baida. The earth will swallow up the group,
okay.
the soldiers of Sufyani. And at that time, Imam Mahdi alayhi salam wal qa'imu yawma'idhin bi Makkah. On that very day, Imam Mahdi alayhi salam is in the city of Mecca. قَدْ أَسْنَدَ زَهْرَهُ إِلَى الْبَيْتِ الْحَرَامِ. He is relying on Kaaba. And فَيُنَادِي يَا أَيُّهَا النَّاسِ. Then he calls all the people. This is in Al-Ghiba by Nu'mani, page 288, chapter 14, hadith number 67.
All right.
So this narration is telling us that Sufyani is
coming at the same time.
At the same yeah. time of the reappearance of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam, those narrations told us that Yamani would be at the time of Sufyani. So the conclusion is that Yamani will come at the time which is very close to the reappearance of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam.
All right, Dr. Karimi will discuss more on that after a short break. Welcome back. You're listening to The Last Savior. We're discussing about the time of uprising of Yamani. Dr. Karimi, before going to the break, you gave us a lot of narrations from Imam Sadiq al-Islam, from Imam Baqir al-Islam. A couple of narrations which say, which conclude that Yamani and Sufyani will be coming at the same time.
The question is that, what do we mean by the same time? Is it on, because according to some narrations, they will fight each other?
Yes.
Which means that they are, very close to each other. But some narrations tell us that the uprising of three people would be on the same day.
Okay.
And by three people, I mean Sufyani, Yamani, and another person who is called Khorasani. We have a person from Khorasan, which may refer to Iran, and he will have a kind of uprising, but he is not usually considered as one of the definite signs for the reappearance of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam.
Okay.
So according to some narrations, these three people would come on the same year, the same month, and the same day.
Okay.
For example, Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam is quoted as saying, خروج Sufyani wal-Yamani wal-Khurasani. The uprising of Sufyani and Yamani and Khurasani, three different people, are fi sanatin wahida, in the same year, fi shahrin wahid, in the same month, fi yawmin wahid, on the same day. This is in Al-Ghiba by Nu'mani, page 262, chapter 14, hadith number 13. In yet another narration, Imam Sadiq alayhi salam is quoted as saying, وَقَدْ يَكُونُ خُرُوجُهُ وَخُرُوجُ الْيَمَانِ مِنَ الْيَمَنِ مَعَ الرَّايَةِ الْبِيضِ فِي يَوْمٍ وَاحِدٍ وَشَهْرٍ وَاحِدٍ وَسَنَةٍ وَاحِدًا.
Yeah.
The uprising of Sufyani and that of Yamani with white flags from Yemen are in the same day, the same month, and the same year.
All right.
And in Al-Ghiba by Sheikh At-Tusi, page 446, we read, خُرُوجُ الثَّلَاثَ, the uprising of the following three people, Khurasani, Sufyani, Yamani, is on the same year, same month, and the same day. And all these narrations are authentic. We do not have time to talk about each one of the narrators, but according to the scholars of Rijal, all these narrations are
authentic.
So the conclusion is that according to these at least three narrations that I have quoted, the uprising of Yamani, Sufyani, and that of Khurasani would be on the same
day.
Even day. Now, the Next point here is that according to a narration, which is an authentic narration from Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, the uprising of Sufyani is in the month of Rajab. Imam Sadiq alayhi salam is quoted as saying, "In amra Sufyani min al-amr al-mahtum." The uprising of Sufyani is one of the definite signs. Wa khurujuhu fi Rajab. His uprising is in the month of Rajab. This is in Kamaluddin, page 650, chapter 57, hadith number 5. So, according to these narrations, Sufyani, Khurasani, and Yamani should come together in a day in the month of Rajab. But all of them, they will come on the same day.
Okay.
Now, here there is one contradicting saying by Muhammad ibn Muslim, according to which Yamani will come before Sufyani.
Okay.
Now, there is a discussion among the scholars how we can remove this contradiction and whether Sufyani and Yamani will come on the same day or Yamani will come before Sufyani. But I will talk about this contradiction in the following session. But the point is that at the end of the day, what is for sure is that they are very close to each other in terms of the time. Either they come on the very day or very close to each other to the extent that they will fight each other. So there is not a gap of time between Yamani and Sufyani.
So we came to a conclusion that Yamani and Sufyani are going to come at the same time. We discussed the fact with narrations from Imam Sadiq al-Islam and Imam Baqir al-Islam and another narration from Imam Sadiq al-Islam, which said there will be three people, Sufyani, Yamani, and even Khurasani, who will be coming on same day, same year. Thank you so much, Dr. Karimi, for being with us. Thank you so much, dear listeners. You were listening to IRIB English Radio. Where is the rising sun? Where is the spring of life? Where is the shining moon? Where is the firmest glow? Please, oh please, please come.
Designing the bomb.
Part 1.
In the beginning, God created light. Based on the old Torah scrolls, Jewish rabbis believe that light was God's first creation. In the 20th century, physicists doubted the nature of light. Was light small particles moving in space, or was it like sea waves? According to Jewish rabbis, water was the second element created by God. Water, with its wave motion, was the first Jewish embodiment of matter. In Jewish mythology, creation was God's will to transform energy into matter. At the beginning of the 20th century, a Jewish scientist from Europe established the equation as his theoretical foundation in physics, a theory in which matter and energy were interchangeable with one another. Albert Einstein, like many other Jewish scientists, immigrated to America with the spread of Nazism and its threat against Jews. At the same time, research into a backlash had begun. This time,
Instead of the movement of energy to matter, the movement of matter to energy was investigated. This reverse move had the opposite result. If the movement of energy into matter led to creation, the movement of matter into energy had a high power of destruction.